I mean, I guess I haven't thought about the story that much because it just sort of feels like you're pushing a rock uphill. But I graduated from Middlebury College in 2010. So Middlebury College is a private school in Vermont and has very high tuition, but we knew it would be doable because of our income, that I would get a lot of need-based aid.
KCUR's summer intern Julia Szabo takes her student debt in stride. She says it's just reality for her generation, but 5 years after graduation, she's still paying for college. She and her parents were thoughtful about the decision to accept loans.
In theory, we thought it would be cheaper than me going to KU because we had so much aid given, but a lot of it was loans that would be repaid later. So during it, it felt like, oh, okay, you know, we have to pay $5,000 out of pocket. That's it. It's doable. But then when we left, it ended up being more like my parents had $20,000 and I had $40,000. And that's all I thought it was. So when I had a full-time job for 2 years, I'd really worked to pay down the original aspect part of the loan and then realized that I had $15,000 more. And I've been paying the minimum on that for a year and a half now. And technically, because of the interest accrued, it looks like I've only paid like $200 off of it. But I've been paying every month. The interest just is unbelievable. I have the lowest that's possible because both of mine are federal loans. So I didn't, you know, get screwed over by some for-profit college or a bad lender. It was the federal government. All my loans are through them.
Yowza. The older I get, the more upsetting it is to think about young people at the starting line of their careers with all that debt. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today's show is a look at how student borrowing results in more than just a monthly check to a lender. Our guests are both KU professors. One struggled to get to college and left with a lot of debt. The other grew up in a world where going to college was a given. She graduated with a spiffy resume and a clean financial slate. They've just co-written a book, The Real College Debt Crisis. Melinda Lewis, welcome to Central Standard.
Thanks so much, Gina.
And Willie Elliott, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
We'll get to your stories in a minute, but for now, you write that higher education is a crucial part of economic mobility in America and that the system is in crisis because of student debt, or just because student debt is our main approach to making college accessible. Explain that.
Well, what we wrote in the book was that you really have to start thinking about student debt in kind of a different way than we have. Typically, people think about student debt, they think about default rates and whether or not people are having struggling paying their loans. But that's not the only way that student loans can create problems for the U.S. economy and for individuals. So one of the things we started thinking about is kind of the equity question. And this has to do with the return on college and to some degree and the value of college. And the current conversation around college is one in which we really have begun to question whether it pays or not to go to college. And we think debt has a lot to do with that and how we're financing our education. And so the question that typically is asked is whether or not a student who goes to college and is better off than if they didn't go to college, right? Whether they had loans or not, are they better off? And then usually the economists would look at the return on college degree over the lifetime. But we started thinking about the question of whether or not a student who has debt does as well as a student who doesn't have debt after they leave college, particularly financially. Do they have as much net worth? Do they buy homes at the same rate? Do they save for retirement? Do they marry? These kinds of questions really began to change the dialogue around thinking about student debt for us. Because then it's about equity. It's about one's effort and ability in school and whether or not that's paying off the same for everyone. And in our system in America, where the American dream is based upon effort and ability, it's really problematic if it's not paying off the same for everyone. It's not just about default, but
what
it's also
what did you find
that
when you looked at it that way? I mean, when you looked at broader kinds of outcomes for students who have taken on debt as compared to those who haven't?
Well, not surprisingly, people who have debt, you know, they don't save as much for retirement or they delay retirement savings. They don't buy a home as early. And then New York Federal Reserve Bank also is finding similar findings around home ownership and they have less net worth. There's a great study by Robert Hilton Smith at Demos that also found that students who have debt have far less net worth in their life. So it's affecting our ability to accumulate assets, which we think is important.
Melinda, how is it that debt repayment mostly affects other areas of the borrower's life and influences major decisions. Can you kind of spell that out for us?
Sure, but it starts a step even back from that. So certainly when you think about one individual or a group of individuals having to divert income to debt repayment post-college, that's where you see the compromise in asset accumulation that Willie referenced. That has, of course, then intergenerational effects. Not only are those who are diverting income to repay student loans not able to save for their own retirements, they're also hindered in their ability to save for their children's educations in ways that then tend to perpetuate those inequities when education is supposed to run directly counter to that and be kind of a leveling force. But we see student debt playing a distorting role in the educational experience even long before the point of repayment.
How early?
It certainly even in the point of cultivating or not expectations about the likelihood of college. We see, and not only in our research, but in some of the evidence that we rely on throughout the book, we see that some groups are more debt averse than others, particularly those disadvantaged students who have grown up in poverty or don't have clear pathways for what economic success might look like. So you may see some students who would otherwise be, quote, college material not go, because rather than having this expectation that college will be affordable to them, they have this looming prospect of student debt. Student debt can also distort children's decisions about where they study and what they study in ways that may have, we don't know a lot about this yet, but may have widespread consequences for our economy because something other than what I am best suited to do and what the economy needs most may be driving decisions about something that is as foundational today as higher education.
Why have student loans been the main tool for making college education affordable and accessible? I mean, have there ever been other models for this?
Well, in the 1980s is really when we saw the shift. The early 1980s, the shift to really financing education through debt. Before that time period, we didn't. So it's a relatively new phenomenon. 1980 seems probably far away for some, but for somebody who's 45, it's not that far ago. Really, we saw that shift then. And what it had to do with is privatization of education, right? So instead of it being a collective good, it started to become seen as this individual good. And so if it's an individual good, then it makes sense that the student...
Yeah, the individual pays for it.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And there's been a great shift in that, whether it be merit aid, student loans, all these things are shift more towards the privatization of education, not seen as purely a social good.
Culturally, what explains that shift? I mean, how did we go from thinking about education as a cultural good and a shared good to being an individual good, something that only benefits the person with the degree?
Well, I don't even know that it's true that that's what Americans think of education as. I think most Americans still believe that education should be really the way that we give children a chance to live the American dream. You know, our American dream, as Willie said earlier, isn't one based on pure equality. It's just equitable opportunity. And the idea that then we create the conditions where how hard you work, kind of how much you bring to the challenge that you face is what determines how well you succeed. And I think that's what we collectively think of as education, education should do. But when states disinvested from public education, such that the cost of education, of higher education, were more clearly pushed onto the shoulders of individual students and their families, at the same time that real wages were stagnant for many in the economic system.
What time period are we talking about again?
Well, again, so you know, we see wages being stagnant since the 1970s for the median American household, and the shift in financial aid away from need-based aid so that the value, the purchasing value of that aid fell in, as Willie said, of the 1980s, in state disinvestment from education, we really saw that accelerating in the early 1990s with that recession. And certainly in this most recent Great Recession, saw states cut back significantly, most of which have not restored those funding levels, even when state economies are now in recovery. So that means that tuition, which is paid by students and their families, makes up a larger share of the budgets of even public institutions that are supposed to be kind of the refuge of affordability. Families borrow to cover those costs.
There was even hints of this. So from President Carter's administration to President Reagan's and how they talked about education and the role of government in financing education, where in the Carter administration was much more about, and before that, was much more about having everyone go to college, making college accessible to everyone. And the government's role in doing that. And then when Reagan came in, not a critique of him, but this is a conversation. We note that in the book, some quotes from the different presidents, where they start talking about it differently, where it is more of an individual responsibility thing, where to pay for college and to fund college. And so that marked a big shift. And at the same time, then we see a shift towards student loans. And part of this was not just, part of it was just to the increase in student loans was to increase access to the middle-income people, right? So in the beginning, it wasn't really thought that student loans would be highly relied on by lower-income families, but a way to increase access for middle-income families. So I don't know if it was anything nefarious or anything, but this is part of what the shift had occurred.
You write that the student loan system has reached a point of crisis, which suggests to you that it might be on the verge of a revolutionary kind of transformation. But first, make the case. I mean, tell me about what characterizes the crisis itself as you see it.
Well, I think one thing we can do is we have a chapter in there where we talk about kind of the myths of things. So it's not the fact that somebody has $100,000 in debt or the number of people who have $100,000 in debt. Because that's a lot of the media conversation. And among some researchers as well. And I think what it has done is because we focused so much on the number of kids who have $100,000 in debt that it hides the real crisis. And for us, the real crisis is the inability of people to accumulate assets. Because if we understand that the wages are stagnant, if we understand that income, personal income, is not only wages, but also capital and transfers. That's the economic definition of personal wages. And so we understand that capital plays a large part in our ability to accumulate income, even in a long term, that if we understand that there are these losses taking place, it's not just about default. And then the other thing is with default is even children with $5,000 or less in debt, right, have high default rates, higher default rates than some kids with a lot more debt. My point is, it's not $100,000 in debt. It's not small debt. We don't really understand how much debt can be harmful. There's not like a magic number of debt that's harmful. It's more the concept of financing education through a debt system that creates the crisis in the first place. And that's why we're starting to have this change around our discussion about whether education pays, people's perception about even whether we should go to two-year colleges as opposed to four-year colleges, right? It's driving so much of the conversation. And it's even affected the interventions that we've created. If we understand, if we think that it's just about default rates, we create things like income-based repayment plans, which are a good thing because they help us solve a problem that we have or a symptom of the system, but doesn't change the system itself. Right. And it actually can, in the long run, might harm things, because if we understand that kids, even with a little bit of debt, end up delaying and not saving and doing these other kinds of things, and we're giving them a system intervention in which we increase the amount of time they have to pay back the loans, it might in the long run really be hurting us.
How do you think that student debt or lack thereof shaped your path after graduation or your decision about whether to attend college in the first place? Call 816-235-2888. You know, Melinda and Willie, authors of The Real College Debt Crisis, you use your own personal stories to explore some of the pressures on students. So let's start with your story, Willie. It begins with football in the town of Beaver Falls, Pennsylvania.
Yeah, so I think what's relevant for our current discussion, I mean, there's a chapter in the book, chapter two, on this. And I think it's one of the exciting things about the book is that it does use these narratives and these stories to help people understand the larger issues at play. So some of the ways a student debt intervened in my life was maybe a quick example. So when I went into the military, right, so you have this option when you go to the military. So I went to college, 4 years of college, came out with about $40,000 in debt as an undergrad. And I took a philosophy major, so I automatically knew I was going on to more schooling at some point. But I went back. I went into the military to pay off my student debt. But when you go into the military to pay off student debt, you can't go in as an officer. You have to go as an enlisted person, which means you have worse housing privileges, less opportunities. You make less money, but you have to have a degree to be an officer. So to me, it was like counterintuitive, right? The one thing you have to have a degree for, if you have debt, you can't do, right? You can't be an officer if you have debt. So that was one way in which student debt really affected some of my career decisions and my options.
But Willie, can we back up more? Because I really want to get your background here. Talk to me about the town where you grew up and the role that, like, what you grew up imagining as your future, where you parked your hopes and dreams as a kid.
Yes. Well, you know, I grew up in a typical Western Pennsylvania community where football dominated Friday nights. And I grew up thinking about in football as my way out for a long time. I didn't even understand that there was a master's degree or a PhD at that point. I just thought of going to Penn State and playing football. And that was kind of like the next logical step in life. And on, you know, any given Friday night, this whole community would come out and watch the games. If you lost, it seemed like everyone's hopes were dashed. And if you won, it was a bunch of excitement in the community.
And it seems like, from what I understood reading it, that that it wasn't just your hope to get yourself out of here, but that other people had their hopes riding on you also.
No, for sure. I mean, and that's the way these kinds of communities work is, it's, you know, you see it as a way of delivering your family from the poverty that we're in. At times we were homeless, and at times, you know, a lot of times we didn't eat, or sometimes you're living in a house in which there's no electric, gas, or anything else. And that can be even worse than being homeless sometimes in some ways. But and so you felt like this was an opportunity to lift your family up, but then also the community. Eventually I ended up quitting playing football my senior year, actually, and ended up dropping out of school at some point because of the pressure once I had quit football was quite immense through the community. And one of the things that some of the community members said to me, which made a lot of sense to me, I understood it, that by me not playing, it meant that less scouts were coming. And so other kids wouldn't have the opportunity to be seen by these scouts and have the opportunity to go. And so, you know, I appreciated that, understood that concern. But so it was for everybody. It was not just for yourself. It was some hope of raising everybody out of poverty, some dream as a kid that you can make some real difference.
And your parents, your father had left school after eighth grade and your mother after high school. Why didn't they get more schooling than that?
I think it was the times, for one. When my dad grew up, it wasn't uncommon for kids to leave school. He didn't get much attention while he was in school. There's a lot of reasons for that. And so his family, you know, his parents didn't go and complete high school either. So it was a combination of things there. He did go on to become an engineer and work really hard and driving trains and stuff like that. My mother, her family didn't believe that girls go on to college. And so there wasn't really an outlet there. And then I'm a product of a biracial marriage. And then when they got married, it wasn't very a popular idea. And so they had to flee town, if you will, and from their parents. And so that also made it kind of impossible at that point to move forward with education.
Yeah, it sounds like the larger support network kind of dissipated.
No, absolutely. I mean, we had no extended family. I didn't grow up knowing grandparents. I mean, even when you think about funny things like SAT tests and stuff, when people, and usually a lot of the questions are weaved in there where they talk about cousins and aunts and uncles and stuff, but they weren't really concepts that I understood or knew because I didn't have any of those things. And so SATs are a long way off, but a lot of times in school they use those kinds of examples, and they really didn't make logical sense to me because I just never experienced those things. We had our immediate four people in our family, and we loved each other and we worked really hard, but that was it.
Tell me, you're talking about SATs. Tell me about high school, because that's where we start setting the stage for college if you're going to go there in earnest.
No, yeah. So essentially, I dropped out in my senior year and started a mission. And I got saved at that point in time and decided that there was something other than football in my life that I wanted to explore and do.
So you've become very religious at this point.
I did. I became very religious at that point, and I opened a mission up downtown about 18, 19, and brought in people who didn't have jobs and who were on alcohol and helped them get jobs. And I didn't really at that point, like I said, because I didn't read much. I mean, I did all my homework. I got A's and stuff for the most part in school, but no broader like sense of college or anything. And so it took me several years working in a mission before I really started thinking about, you know, I really could use a lot more education to do this more effectively.
So how did you end up in college after this break in your formal education? That's often just the end for a lot of people.
Well, I think that very thing. It was the fact that I was working in this mission, trying to help these people out, and realized I just needed more education to do this effectively. And there was a Christian college in Beaver Falls called Geneva College, and I went there. And I went there on probation because I had dropped out of high school, and so I spent the first couple years on probation, but graduated with honors and so forth.
How did you find the funding to go to college? I mean, talk to me about the
took
decision.
Out loans.
Yeah, talk to me about that decision-making process.
For me, at that point, football had gone, and I really saw it as my one hope for doing the things that I wanted to do, and so I was willing to take on the debt that I needed to do it. And I think that's one of the interesting things is, oftentimes we talk about this, about making kids more educated about taking out debt, right? But if your only hope and option, and it's the best option you can see, and everybody's telling you it's the best option, is to go to school, and the way you can finance it is through debt, well, you're going to take on a lot more debt because you don't see any other options. And so that's the kind of way I approached it. I figured it will pay off in the long run, and it might not pay off much as for me as for others, but it's going to pay off more than what I had. And so, and I think that is the case. I can still say that today, that is the case. College did pay off for me. It might have took me longer to reach some of the milestones in life that others reached, but it was still a worthwhile investment. I just, you know, takes a lot longer.
You talked a little bit ago about joining the Army, but that wasn't a first step. I mean, at first you were headed to law school. You graduated with $40,000 of debt. Is that right?
That's correct. And I went to law school for a year. Just realized that I needed more money, that my family at that point were helping finance me to go to school in a sense of providing me with a house and stuff like that. But I was working before that, helping provide money. I didn't realize how important that was to my family's ability to maintain. And them wanting to see me go into law school, they didn't make it as evident to me of how important it was. And they ended up losing their house. And so really at the end of my first year in law school, even though I had some scholarships at that point for law school, to help my family out and to pay back the loans, I decided just to go into the military.
So those early days in the military, talk to me about how you get from joining the Army to eventually you're a KU professor. There's still quite a journey there.
Yeah, well, when I went into the military, I believed that I would be able to and was made to believe that I'd be able to take my law school while I was there. But at the point, I could still run fast and jump high. And so I did a lot of training. And every time I kind of started school, they would ship me somewhere different and for this class or that class, and ended up not finishing my law degree while I was there. When I got out, I was stop loss for a short period of time, and I ended up eventually becoming a paralegal back in Ohio. And I did that for a year and just realized that that I needed to get back into school. Well, that was really my only option at that point in time, because the paralegal job wasn't financing. I had a family at that point, two kids. And so I ended up applying to WashU for law school and social work, and I didn't get any real money in the law school program. And so I just went with this school of social work. Ended up at WashU, which was great. I mean, and that's another thing people would critique, is that I went to a selective college. I mean, WashU is one
of
the—
A private school.
Yeah, and really, it's like a Harvard in a sense of rankings. And so, but it was really a worthwhile event, even though I accumulated a lot of debt there. You get so much social capital. And what's amazing about our stories is we really went at them different ways. I think Belinda's story is equally important. But we will get to that. We ended up at the same spot, which is interesting, right? We both end up going to WashU, end up going to, you know, take a social work degree. I think it was really worthwhile. And I think if people understood the advantages of a private selective college, I teach at KU now, but the resources at WashU are much higher.
Willie Elliott, stay with me through the break. Central Standard will be right back. When we return, Willie's co-author on the real college debt crisis will share her story, a very different story. We'll want to hear yours too. I'm Gina Kaufman, back in a minute. I'm Gina Kaufman. You're listening to Central Standard. We're talking with the co-authors of a book called The Real College Debt Crisis. They use their personal stories to illustrate larger points about how student debt affects everything from how quickly graduates benefit from their college educations to the range of career options that seem available. We just heard the story of Willie Elliott, who came from a poorer community that saw sports as the ticket out and whose college debt temporarily derailed him, rerouting him toward enlisting in the Army. He's ended up as a KU professor in social welfare. Hi again, Willie.
Hello.
Now let's talk with Melinda Lewis. Melinda, where does your story begin?
Well, and I think as you said a little bit in the introduction, Gina, my family was not and is still not wealthy, which I think is what makes the juxtaposition of our stories more universally salient. You're right, if this was a story of kind of extreme excess of privilege, then it would be more clearly kind of easier to disregard the role of assets. It would also mean that the kind of policy path is different. I mean, one of the pieces of my story is that it didn't take huge infusions of assets for assets to be really transformative. So as you said, I think it starts with expectations.
So what were the expectations in your upbringing?
Right. So as I was saying, that the my parents had enough of an asset base for me to know from before I really even knew what college was, that it was a part of my future. And I was surrounded by people who had gone to college. My parents and Willie talked about the kind of lack of extended family. I had aunts and uncles who had gone to college. It wasn't a multi-generational thing. My own grandparents had not gone to college. Most of them hadn't even graduated from high school. But by the time I was old enough to think about what school meant to me and what I was supposed to do in school, it was a college-bound path that laid out in front of me. And it was my parents' assets, the fact that there was some money put aside in a savings account that was for me to go to college, that made that a real expectation, not just this kind of vague hope that was supposed to get me there.
Talk to me about high school for you.
For me, one of the other ways that assets were really significant was my parents' ability to purchase what I now see as educational advantages. And again, we're not talking elite private institutions. I went to a public high school, graduated from Olathe North here in the Kansas City area. But my parents could afford to live in a neighborhood that had high quality public schools. I was able to get a lot of college credit while I was still in high school because they could pay out of pocket the still affordable at the time public tuition that was required for me to be able to do that.
And you write about the purchase of a camera. I think that that's sort of an interesting illustration. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. Well, so one of the things that we think that assets can do for children in terms of their educational environment, too, is change their parents' expectations. So it's not just what a child thinks they're going to do, but what the parent thinks that they are going to be able to help their child do and how they need to prepare for that. So my dad started from a very young age kind of running with whatever idea I had so that he could encourage me to develop. And for a while when I was younger, I was convinced I was going to be a photojournalist. So when friends would say, what their career aspirations were, that at the time was mine. And so rather than just, say, that's great, hun, in some sort of really kind of ill-defined way, he purchased me a camera that I didn't know how to use because you had to set all the apertures and f-stops. But he purchased me a book that went with it and taught me or helped me learn how to do that. And it's, again, those kinds of investments that take education from the realm of the
and the ability to make those investments,
right, from the vague future to this is where you're headed and here are some steps we're going to take together today to make it more likely that you get there.
How did you decide where to go to college and how to pay for it? Was this a collective decision of your family and your school community?
Not so much the school, I think. Certainly it was a continuation of the conversations that I'd had with my parents since I was very young. Again, they had the assurance of knowing that higher education was going to be possible for me because there was money with my name on it that was set aside to help me pay for that. My dad was honest about the fact that they didn't have enough money to pay for me to go away to an elite private institution. And I was a National Merit Scholar. One of the things Willie talked about when we were talking before the break is about the shift away from need-based to merit-based aid. My family made enough that we would never have qualified for need-based aid. And I was going to school at a time when merit, as understood in our educational system, was highly rewarded. And again, my parents had helped me to make some of the investments that positioned me to compete for that kind of assistance. And so with that national merit distinction, then I went to the University of Kansas without paying for tuition.
And did you work your way through college? Did you have a job?
I worked some. I wouldn't say I worked my way through college. most of the money that I earned actually went to help me do study abroad. So I used some of the money that my parents had set aside for me and supplemented that with my own earnings and studied Spanish in every summer, eventually becoming fluent in Spanish as well.
Willie, I didn't ask you that question. Did you have a job through your college years?
Particularly through my graduate school years, I worked pretty much full time throughout the PhD program and the MSW program.
I'm curious about how these different kinds of requirements of a working life outside of school affected maybe the resumes that you built or the decisions that you made about how much and how in depth you could pursue your educations?
Well, you know, I think it's the amount of effort that it takes to get to the same point, right? And that has a long-term effect on your body, your mind, and everything else. It's that equity thing, right? So, certainly, I didn't have the opportunity for the study abroads and those kind of things, and I think that does affect the resume some. But really, what I saw is what I think of as the real problem is the amount of effort that it's required of you to achieve very similar results is disheartening in some ways. America is supposed to be about equal opportunity, and that means not equal outcomes, but about if you have similar ability, similar effort, you should be able to achieve the same kinds of outcomes. And I think if you look at the stories, even when you buy a house and where you buy a house afterwards, I was strapped with $100,000 in debt by the time I got out of my PhD program. And so
And you guys were in the same PhD program.
I don't even have a PhD. I mean, that's part of the reason we used our stories, because as Willie said, if we believe the American dream should be about you are equitably rewarded for how much of your own talent and ability you invest, really by any objective measure. I worked hard. I'm not trying to say I didn't, but I didn't get as much education even, didn't invest as much of myself, and yet still have a return on that degree in terms of financial outcomes now in adulthood. That is really outsized in relation to what I put in.
Well, let's hear what our callers have to say about this. We're inviting you to join this discussion about student debt and paying for college, how that affects bigger decisions in your lives. We're going to turn now to those callers. Let's hear from Jeremy in Overland Park. Hi, Jeremy.
Hi, how you doing, Gina?
Great. How about you?
Doing great. Just living the dream.
Tell us your story.
Yeah, this conversation definitely strikes a chord with my wife and I. We've been pretty much off and on going to college since 2005, and it's been extremely difficult to pay for school. I mean, when we were young and single, we could work full-time, and tuition was cheaper, so we could pay our own tuition. But as we got married and had two kids, it became even harder to work full time or to keep paying for school. So we've had to turn to student loans. And I did like they talked about a little about the decisions you have to make. You know, I ended up taking a degree in liberal arts because I didn't want to stay in school for so long and needed to get out, pay out those debts. But then it kind of got hard to keep a job. So my wife had to go back to school and go to grad school. But the only way to pay for it all is student loans. In fact, it's gotten to a point since we have our kids, I need to stay home and take care of our kids, and she'll need to go to school. So the only way to survive is those loans.
So am I hearing you saying, too, that like there have been a lot of starts and stops that are partly related to this, or is that unrelated?
No, it's related to it. Like I said, I finally settled on a degree that I need to get quickly so I can get a job so I could kind of pay back the loans. But with the economy being the way it was in the job market, it was hard to keep that job. So we thought the only way to get ahead is to get a better job. And to get that better job, we need better education. So that's why my wife decided to go to grad school. And I stay with the kids so that way they're taken care of as well, because they have their educational needs that we need to address as well.
So the difficulty of providing for a family, getting an education, and trying to do it all at once.
Jeremy, I kind of had a similar experience when I got out of the military and I took the paralegal job and wasn't supporting the family that I had. And really we had an option of either going back home, living with our parents, or going on for more college. And so which going on for more college meant, you know, going back into debt because we just had paid it all off through the military.
So it seems like the part of the issue with things taking longer, perhaps, on this sort of path of debt is that when you're doing things later in life, a family can often come into the equation. And this isn't just behind you. You haven't already worked through all these things.
Right. Well, and I mean, I think Jeremy's story, too, illustrates some of the ways the debt can interfere with college completion. And, you know, access isn't the greatest challenge that we have, really, in terms of facilitating greater attainment. It's completion. And it's another way that financial limitations can intrude on the realization of those educational goals.
I think it also makes all the decision making much more complex. Yeah. So Jeremy spoke about taking a degree that he might not have taken because he was mm-hmm. afraid of debt, right? And so at so many different stages, we're making so many decisions really dependent upon our fear of debt. And that's problematic. When we think about education as a great equalizer in society and that role it's supposed to play, if people are being forced to make decisions on whether they take a certain degree or go to a certain college based on debt, really is not where we want to be.
So, let's hear from one more caller before we head off to break. Mark in Prairie Village. Hi, Mark.
Hi. I'm sort of in between your two guests. Went to college in the late 60s, early 70s. Well, actually through the 70s, but undergrad school, late 60s, early 70s. And there was a federal program to enable middle-class people to go to college. I think it was called the National Student Defense Loan Fund. And the advantage, which is not around any longer, was you got money at 3%. And the biggest part was that it didn't accumulate interest until 9 months after you finished whatever final program you were going through. So I went undergraduate school and accumulated a certain amount of debt, but got to finish graduate school before 9 months after I finished graduate school, before interest started accumulating, and I had to pay it back. So it was pretty much guaranteed to have a job and an income at the point at which I had to pay it back. It was a huge advantage.
And is that something that's a program that's changed, or is that still a path that's available to
exists.
People?
I haven't kept up on the subject, but I don't think anything like that exists. The reason I wanted to call in was because it was a federal program. It was not a matter of aimed at poor people, although we had no money. My parents couldn't pay for me to go to college. But loan scholarships working and a relative that contributed some, I managed to go to a very good school.
Well, thanks, Mark. Is that something that either of you have heard about, and what explains the shift?
I mean, in all honesty, we kind of approached the study of student debt from the back door a bit. We study assets and how assets can catalyze educational outcomes, and so then became concerned with the role that debt was playing in our financing. So we're not the experts on some of the intricacies of the different structures of student loan programs, but it certainly illustrates the case that, that a financial aid program for the 21st century is within our reach. And we know what the different components would have to be and how we could put that together for students like Mark.
Central Standards headed to one more break. Call 816-235-2888 and tell us how debt or lack thereof shaped your path, both during college and after graduation. Do you have the same opportunities as everyone else? I'm Gina Kaufman. Don't go away. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. Today's show is about student debt. Is the burden of repaying student loans about more than that monthly check you have to write? Did your college loan put you on a level playing field or not? You've got just a little time to get your 2 cents in at 816-235-2888. Our guests are two KU professors of social welfare. One struggled to get to college and left with a mountain of debt. The other came from a world where higher ed was an expectation and graduated without financial burden. They've co-written a book, The Real College Debt Crisis. Willie Elliott, Melinda Lewis, welcome back.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And we'll keep talking to some of our callers about this because a lot of people have stories to tell. Let's talk with Kim. Kim is calling us from Overland Park. Hi, Kim.
Hi. Well, we have one for you. We're the generation that started this whole debt thing. My husband and I went to college in the 80s. We are in our late 40s. We have a kid that's going to go to college in 4 years because my in-laws are college professors. Same thing, my parents are public school teachers. My husband is a public defender. I'm a school teacher. And we're going to still be paying our own college loan debts off as we send a child to college. So that is, I mean, it is a debt crisis. I mean, we're sending a second generation off, and we're hoping to pay more of her college so she doesn't start out the way we have, because it has impacted our life choices, you know, the cars we drive, the house we have, if we get to go on vacation or not, if we get to go out to eat, because we have this huge student loan debt bill every month, and we've had it since we've graduated from college.
I don't think I'm supposed to ask questions, but I want to ask a question, Kim. It's very interesting to me. You said you have a kid that's going off. So I look at my kids now, and, you know, I have this large amount of debt, and I really tried to protect not limiting their opportunities because of my debt, which I think is an interesting dynamic that we don't
even... Just a psychological, in addition to financial dynamic.
It's both psychological, and then it's not one of transferring that on. So you want to, even if you haven't paid off all your debt, you want to pay for your kids to go to college, right? You don't want that to be a continuous thing.
And Kim, how are you dealing with that? I mean, how are you talking to your kids about it? Do you see options that involve not transferring debt?
Well, what's sad is my husband is an alum from Northwestern University in Chicago, and two of my daughters, and my kids are all extremely smart for one thing, but they want to go there. And we're like, I don't know if you want to go there. We're still paying daddy's college degree off now, and we're almost 50. I mean, you might want to think about KU or K-State, and let's get as many JUCO hours as we can. You're going to be taking advanced placement in high school. You may, you know, so it's balancing that. So, and then it's balancing life skills. It's like, I don't want my kids to have a job in high school because AP is really hard, but they're going to have jobs in the summer. So it's like, I want them all to wait tables and be, you know, do retail at some point in their life so they're good, better people. But how are you supposed to do that when you're trying to make college cheaper for them? It's a struggle. My husband and I lose sleep over it, literally. Like, we have four kids that are going to go to college, and we're still paying off our own student loans.
And Kim's not alone. The Pew Center just did a report last fall on Generation X, which sounds like Kim falls in there, and about how while Gen Xers are earning more than their parents, they're not doing as well as their parents in terms of net worth and asset accumulation at precisely the moment when they need to be preparing for their own children's higher education and their own retirement. So that's where, yes, this is experienced by all of us through our own stories and our own journeys, but there are also really significant national implications when you multiply these struggles across an entire generation.
I want to hopefully get a couple of other stories, but just to make sure we don't miss this, I mean, what are some options other than student loans that could be available, like, in society? Is there really another option? I mean, student loans may not be perfect, but at the same time, it's better than nothing. And Willie, I mean, you made the point that you are sitting at the same table right now as Melinda and that it might have taken longer, but ultimately, there's something that worked about that.
Yeah, no, so I want to backtrack and then I'll answer that question. I'll be quick on the backtrack. It's interesting, though. So, for instance, my daughter is in gymnastics, and which is an expensive sport. And you think about it. Well, you haven't paid off all your student loans yet. Should you be making these investments in your kids? I mean, you really dabble with it. And people will blame you for that to some degree, right? You should pay off your loans and not do these things for your kids. So it really creates this conflict.
People really say that?
Not about gymnastics per se, but generally speaking, people think like, you know, you should pay off your debt. Don't do anything else. Don't have stakes, right? All that kind of stuff. Just pay off your debt, which makes sense. But with regards to your kids, that's a difficult thing to say. Your life now is going to be disadvantaged. But moving to your question, I think there are alternatives. And this is one of the things we really have confronted among a lot of leading scholars within the field of student debt is some of them say, you know, they're afraid to show any evidence that student debt is negative because they're fearful that there's no alternative. And given our current political climate, they don't believe that an alternative is even possible. And so one of the things we've tried to do is help people understand that there are alternatives and that it might take a little bit of a fight to get them, but it can be done. And one of those things we talk about, so A, I would say there's both short-term and long-term solutions. And I'm going to give you a long-term solution, which is about changing the system of how we think about financing college. And that's around children's savings accounts. We really believe that if you can start saving early on, from a young age and not think about saving when you're in 10th grade, preparing for it, you can accumulate a lot of money in these accounts. I don't know how much time we have. I don't want to go into too much depth. But I'll say one other thing about those. We do understand that low-income people can save small amounts of money. And so we also talk about things like a Pell Grant and putting those into these accounts early on. And so that the kids can leverage that money, save on that money, and their families can build interest on that money over time.
So even a little bit of savings is a start.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Let's talk to Sylvia in Kansas City, Kansas. Hi, Sylvia.
Hi. I know there isn't much time, and I very much enjoyed this conversation. And I'll just quickly go my experience, and I am a WashU alum. I'm originally from New York City, and when it was time to apply for financial aid, my parents were like, you apply all over the country. And I think by doing that, sometimes it opens doors that you might not have thought about when they're looking for students who are from a certain part of the country. So that's another help sometimes in terms of admissions and in terms of financial aid.
So and looking the really thing, broadly.
Looking broadly. And then also being strategic. For graduate school, I ended up going to UC Berkeley. And I knew that California had in-state tuition after living there for several years. So that's what I did. And
So moved there first.
I moved there first and then knew that I would be able to get into tuition. And so things like that, I think, are still out there for people to try to do.
So Sylvia,
so a little bit crazy.
Yeah, this is an interesting point because that's another example of it's a process to go live somewhere for a while, become in-state. So that kind of goes back to this point of it sometimes is a matter of how much time it takes.
Well, it also illustrates the extent to which the higher education system is just that, like a system to be navigated. And that's not a level playing field either. You know, my decision to go in-state for free and use resources later for graduate school was aided by having college-educated parents with financial sophistication who could help me navigate that. Precisely some of the supports that are lacking for students who approach higher education from a disadvantage. So good strategies for the individual, but not a way to build a truly equitable education structure.
I missed my cue there. But this is not wouldn't really be a solution anyhow, because not everybody can move to a certain state, right? It's not feasible to think about. Everybody wants to go to college to move to state X or Y. It is a lot of what we're doing right now, whether it be income-based repayment plans, which I think are very useful, moving to different states, whatever else, are all about the symptoms of the larger problem. And we need to do something that actually addresses the actual problem, which is student debt.
When you say something that addresses it, what can?
Well, I think a lot of things. Well, sorry. I think the children's savings accounts would be one. Well, I think it's taken over a lot of places. A lot of states are starting to go towards that. And really thinking progressively about these scholarships and stuff and putting them into these accounts early on so people have meaningful amounts of money in their accounts later on.
Well, that's all the time we have for today's show. We could probably discuss this for several hours, so if you want to continue the conversation in our Twitter feed, we welcome that. We're at KCURCST. Melinda Lewis, thanks for being here today.
Thank you so much.
And Willie Elliott, I really appreciate your sharing your story and research.
Thank you.
Both of today's guests come to us from KU's School of Social Welfare. They've just co-written a book called The Real College Debt Crisis. To listen back to this conversation or share it with your friends, go to kcur.org/centralstandard. We'll have it available for download later today. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, we'll meet a guy who builds prehistoric life models here in Kansas City, including a controversial take on Lucy, the common human ancestor. That's tomorrow on Central Standard. Our show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. I'm Gina Kaufman. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Up to Date next.